Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm battling a flu. So fortunately for you, the episode you're about to listen to was actually recorded before the flu set in. So you only have to listen to this part of me for a little bit. But this is episode 92, and it's on Tudor Wales. And I'm talking to Nathan Amin. He is the founder of the Henry Tudor Society. He's also written a book called Tudor Wales. And even more important to me, I suppose, because I'm selfish like that, is that he and I are putting together a tour of Tudor Wales this coming spring, late April, early May of 2018. So in this episode, we're going to talk about Tudor Wales in general and the tour that we're putting together specifically as well. So it's going to be lots of great information about places to go in Tudor Wales and some of the great stories behind some of these places. Now, if you're interested in coming on the tour with us, please go to englandcast.com/tours. englandcast.com/tours, and I'll put a note or I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, so it will be easy enough for you to find. But englandcast.com/tours has all of the full itinerary, the pricing, everything like that, what's included, all of it. So please go there and check that out if you want to come to Tudor Wales with Nathan and myself this coming spring. I'm not going to do my full admin that I normally do because this episode's really long and I'm losing my voice already. But I will just remind you that the Agora Podcast Network is actually available for advertising. The member podcasts in Agora receive nearly 1 million downloads a month together. So if you have an audience that you think fits in with our listenership, they're people who are into history, they're smart, they're well-read, they're people who are into politics, lots of different podcasts, they're part of our network. Check out agorapodcastnetwork.com to learn more and to find out the advertising rates, everything like that. Also, people who download and listen to Agora Podcast Network podcasts are much better looking than average podcast listeners. Just saying. And this is normally the part where I read out my amazing Patreon supporters, and I do love you guys, but I'm not going to read them all out right now because this is a really long episode and the aforementioned losing of my voice. But with that said, I want to welcome my newest Patreon supporter, Olivia. Thank you so much. And also, Al, you're amazing. You just upped your support. So thank you so much. If you love this show and if you want to support independent podcasting, go over to patreon.com/englandcast and find out how you can support the show for as little as a dollar an episode. So now I'm going to jump right into my interview with Nathan, and you're going to hear all about Tudor Wales. Again, englandcast.com/tours to find out about the tour.
What can you tell me about the early Tudors in Wales and kind of where the House of Tudor comes from, as it were, and there's stories of these Welsh princes and everything like that. What can you tell me about them?
Well, I mean, the two things that we need to consider when we discuss the Tudors, obviously, there's so many different lines of ancestry. You know, each of us have got, what is it, 4 grandparents and so on. The two lines that I really focus on when I discuss the Welsh Tudors is really, it goes through their father's line, so their grandfather's line, Owen Tudor, because, of course, Henry Tudor was not wholly Welsh descended in that, you know, he's got French and English ancestry as well. But his father's father, so the patrilineal line of descent, if you want, the the Welsh side. The Tudors themselves, going back in the male line, come from Anglesey, an island off the northwest of Wales. It's a bit, you know, we're kind of backporting a little bit when we call them the Tudors, because the Welsh didn't go by surnames then. They were, you know, they followed a system, whereas, for example, Owen Tudor's authentic name would be Owain ap Meredydd, which is Owen, son of Meredith.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a Tudor as we would perhaps consider a surname. But certainly the father's line were all based around the small Welsh village of Penmynydd on Anglesey.
Hmm.
And in particular, at the end of the 14th century, there were five brothers, which, for argument's sake, we now call the Tudors of Penmynydd, because their father was, his first name was Tudor. So, for example, his children were Rhys ap Tudur, Gwilym ap Tudur, Meredydd ap Tudur, and so on. So the five brothers all were, you know, Meredith, son of Tudor. So we call them the Tudors of Penmynydd because it's just easier to use. Now, these five brothers, they were, by 1400, there were three surviving, Gwilym, Rhys, and Meredydd. And they became involved in the Owain Glyndŵr Welsh Wars of Independence. Owain, you know, today is a Welsh hero. I often, because of Hollywood, perhaps the easiest way to describe him is the Welsh William Wallace, you know, leading this national rising against the English, which failed. But the three Tudor brothers, surviving Tudor brothers, were his first cousins. So they joined his rebellion and they became his closest allies throughout the 10-year rebellion. The problem was that this rebellion failed. Owain Glyndŵr disappeared into hiding. Nobody knows whatever happened to him. And the two of the brothers were caught and executed. That left one brother, Meredydd ap Tudur. We don't really know what happened to him, but it seems that he died during the rebellion. He left a son called Owen. Now, Wales, after the collapse of the rebellion, had been destroyed. You know, what hadn't been set on fire by Owain Glyndŵr had been set on fire by the English king. So, you know, you pretty much had a war going on and the entire country got razed to the ground. So there was no...
the English king at this time for people?
That would have been Henry IV. Now the Tudors were, ironically for how, you know, the English royal descent went, were loyal to Richard II. And so is Owain Glyndŵr. It's quite, probably far too complex to go into on a podcast. But, you know, the Welsh uprising happened pretty much exactly as Richard II got deposed. So the Lancastrians came onto the English throne. The Tudors were against the Lancastrians, which can be quite confusing when later on we consider how the Tudors became the Lancastrians, right, in effect. But basically what happened was there was nothing left in Wales for a young boy known as Owen. He had no, you know, his family had been wiped out. We don't know what happened to his mother. And there was no opportunity. So you find at this time, quite a few Welshmen had no option that other than to join up with Henry IV's army in France and just go off and fight war because their country had been burnt to the ground. Mm-hmm. Owen seems to have moved to London. And it's from there, really, that the Tudor story as English royal families kicked off. And that Owen then goes on to meet Catherine of Valois, etc. So we got these Tudors on the one side, and they themselves gone further back in this line were the sons, you know, the sons, grandsons, etc., of a guy called Ednafed Vychan. Ednafed was probably the most powerful man in North Wales for a period in the 13th century, other than the princes of Wales at that time, one of whom is known as Llywelyn the Great. Mm-hmm. So he was basically his prime minister, his you know, his chief counsellor. Now, Wales, generally speaking, was never really ruled as one country as we know it today. Generally speaking, it was a North Welsh kingdom and a South Welsh kingdom. So these Tudors were of the North Welsh kingdom, and at best, through Nafad Vakhan, they became effectively prime ministers, you know, the main servant to the princes. Mm-hmm. But Nafad married the daughter of a South Welsh king called the Lord Rhys ap Gruffydd. So through her, and her name was Princess Gwenllian, Nafad's blood had maternal kingly descent. And through Gwenllian, they were descended from all the great ancient Welsh kings, going back, you know, the 9th century, 8th century, and so on. Famous kings such as Howel Dda, Rhodri Mawr, and a guy called Rhys ap Tudor. Perhaps there's a suggestion that the Tudor name that the North Welsh lot used, Nafad's descendants, was perhaps in homage to the South Welsh king. So it's very much because of a marriage by, you know, they weren't common, the North Welsh Tudors, but they themselves weren't the royalty. They married in effect, but that still gave them the connection all the way back to all the ancient Welsh kings. And beyond there, you tend to get into the legendary Welsh kings then, you know, King Arthur and so on, which is where Henry Tudor eventually said, I am, you know, Arthur's heir, and so on. So it's through that particular link, Princess Gwenllian and Nafad Vakhan in the 13th century, that the Tudors ultimately claimed to be the great descendants of Welsh kings.
I see.
And so the best thing I can recommend is Wikipedia and checking out some family trees.
Right.
It's quite a handy resource for that. I know it's, you know, it's not perhaps the best sourced, etc., but it's correct as far as I recognise it. Easier to see the names, really, I think, than to hear me say them if you're not Welsh speaking.
Although it's lovely to hear you say them in an authentic accent. So wonderful.
Thank you.
So, okay, so we've got Owen, and he is in France. And tell me what happened to him after that. How did he get to be working with Catherine of Valois as the keeper of her wardrobe, I think it was? How did that happen?
The one problem we have with Owen Tudor is it's very much a case of perhaps, maybe, you know, it's real, I'd say, educated guesswork, but ultimately none of us are going to have the guaranteed answers. You know, there's a lot of myths and a lot of romanticized notions of Owen Tudor built up that have become these quote facts, unquote. Mm-hmm. The more likely, from what I can gather, the most likely route of this was he served in France under a guy called Sir Walter Hungerford, who is quite a high-up captain in Henry V's French army. Walter Hungerford had connections with Catherine de Valois. I believe he was in a household for a while, and he himself was pretty much based around the Windsor area, which is where Catherine retired, probably seems the wrong word for a woman who is only 22, 23 years old. But after the death of her husband, Henry V, that's where she effectively was sent to live, Windsor Castle. Uh-huh. It seems probable that Owen Tudor, who was serving Walter Hungerford, got some kind of route in to the Queen's household. There doesn't seem to be any obvious reason why this, you know, random Welshman of no noble title, of no particular wealth, should suddenly have become so prominent in the household, other than, you know, an almost act of nepotism. You know, he must have had a master or a colleague or an ally in quite higher place to get him this in. Mm-hmm. And it seems Walter Hungerford is the obvious link. Mm-hmm. So whatever his actual role and his prominence in Catherine de Valois' household, he got in and he must have, you know, charmed her or must have made himself noticeable somehow, some way, of which, unfortunately, we don't have any actual knowledge. It obviously worked wherever he did.
Whatever he did, yeah. So there's the secret marriage. So we're actually starting off our tour in Windsor. What can you tell me anything about what we know about his life in Windsor, other than that he made Catherine Valois fall in love with him?
Basically, yes, you've hit the nail on the head.
Okay.
We've got a couple of these legends that have built up about him, about how he met her. One odd one being that he was swimming one day in a pond, and Queen Catherine, she came across him with her servant, and she saw him, and she seems to have fancied him a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the story goes, I stress there's no real contemporary evidence of this. It's pretty much comes from the Tudor era. So how much those writers were just trying to create this romantic story between, you know, their king's ancestors. But the one story goes that she decided to put on her servant's clothes and go down and see Owen Tudor. And he was perhaps a bit hasty in his amorous feelings for her, and he seems to have cut her on the cheek. The next day at dinner, when he was supposedly serving her, he noticed it was actually the queen who had the cut on her cheek, which seemed a very weird way of starting a relationship, to be honest.
Yeah.
And perhaps it doesn't seem very romantic to us that, you know, he cut the queen and she fell in love with him.
Yeah.
The other story goes, perhaps the most famous one, is that he simply got drunk at some sort of royal ball and fell into her lap. And she supposedly took a fancy to him.
The neither BBC of those seem that attractive, really.
Yeah, it's a bit... I mean, I could see how they could perhaps... And I have read how they can jazz it up in some historical fictions.
Yeah.
But the very basis of them... I mean, I would probably speculate myself that he was in the household. They would have interacted. And it's just, you know, as we do today, we perhaps might go to work or we might go to some form of, you know, communal gathering, I don't know, a conference or a meeting, and you just start speaking to one another and you just, you know, in progress is from there. You have the obvious issue of the different levels in society, but at the end of the day, you know, these people at these balls, at these meals, they wouldn't have passed them without communication. You know, there would have been times where she's perhaps walking around the local parks. She wouldn't have been doing that alone. She would have had her household around her. What I particularly like is the BBC newsreader, Hugh Edwards. He did a programme a couple of years ago called The Story of Wales. And he summed it up as, you know, she was at a ball, he got drunk, he fell on her lap, they fell in love. And he summarised it simply as saying, that's the Welsh charm. And maybe it was. Maybe Owen Tudor just had a bit of Welsh charm and he, you know, talked to the Queen and she fell in love with him. Unfortunately, we will not know for 100%.
So then they had a secret wedding and they had their children. And when we're doing our tour, the next place we're going after we start at Windsor, we're going to Raglan Castle. What can you tell me about Raglan Castle and how that kind of fit in with the stories of the Tudors?
Well, Raglan Castle is one of the most fantastic ruins in all of the UK. It's quite unique in that it was built, you know, in the early to mid 15th century. So it's one of the last great medieval castles that was built before they moved on to becoming more pleasure palaces. And it was built in the French style. And perhaps there's a speculation that it was built by a guy called William Ap Thomas, a Welshman, and he was serving in France. So there's some sort of speculation he perhaps saw these wonderful hexagonal type castles in France and decided to build his own. Because anyone who's been to Raglan, if you just Google the pictures, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about when you look at the gatehouse. It's unlike anything else in the UK. It was described in during the Elizabethan age, you know, 1587, it was described by one writer as a rare and noble sight. And I think it still is. You know, 400-500 years later, it is, you know, it is noble and it certainly is rare. Raglan Castle enters the Tudor story in that at 4 years old, Henry Tudor was the Yorkists took the throne in 1461. When Henry Tudor was just 4 years old. His bloodline, he was a youth who could perhaps be of danger to the Yorkists down the line. So he was given as a ward to a man called William Herbert of Raglan.
Mm-hmm.
and effectively he moved into Raglan. And Henry Tudor lived in Raglan between the ages of 4 years old and 12 years old. His guardian, William Herbert. And it was there that he was educated. It was there that he was brought up. If any place we can really call his childhood home, it's going to be Raglan. You know, Raglan Castle is where he developed. The man he eventually became owes a lot to his upbringing. He was educated in, he studied the classics. He possibly studied Welsh or learned Welsh at the time. He learned martial arts. Everything he learned, he was brought up as a noble child at Raglan. So this is the one place, really, we can consider his childhood home. It's where he was bred. You have one particular tower, which is known as the Great Tower of Gwent, Gwent being the region it's in, and you can still climb to the top of that, and you get incredible views over the mountain range that's nearby. You know, you can see for many miles from the top of that gatehouse.
Wow.
You also have the surviving Elizabeth, because obviously, you know, these castles didn't stop with the 15th century. They got reinvented. And there's a great, the Great Hall was rebuilt in the Elizabethan age. And it's got these incredibly large mullioned windows. I mean, it is fantastic. So although it's still a ruin, because the windows are almost still intact, you can really picture what it must have been like, you know, the light that would have come in. They've got a cobbled courtyard. And, you know, Raglan Castle is truly one of the best castles in the UK, and I include all of them in that, you know, whether it's Windsor Castle, Bamborough Castle, Raglan Castle is definitely up there. And like I said, if you've never seen it, give it a Google and you'll see what I mean.
Yeah. And so then that was Henry. The next day we're going to Carmarthen, huh? Did I say that right, Carmarthen?
Carmarthen.
Carmarthen.
The difference with the Welsh is that we tend to put our emphasis on different parts of the words that might seem obvious to English speakers. So Carmarthen, I would say.
Carmarthen. And that's the oldest town in Wales, right, you said? And tell me about, that's more for Henry's father, for Edmund. Tell me about the role that that played for them.
Well, this Carmarthen does, and the story of Edmund Tudor fits in very well with Raglan, if in reverse, in that the reason Henry Tudor ended up at Raglan is because of what happened in Carmarthen. Edmund Tudor, around about 1455, 1456, you know, the Wars of the Roses were just about to erupt. There was a lot of factional discord going on in England. You know, the Yorkists and the Lancastrians were aligning. Edmund Tudor was, you know, he was the half-brother of Henry VI. So Henry VI was where his allegiances lay. Now, where a large section of Wales, you know, the area in southeast Wales was Yorkist land.
Mm-hmm.
West Wales, Carmarthen and beyond, was Lancastrian land. Mm-hmm. So Carmarthen was very much a frontier town. And Edmund Tudor was sent down there as a son of a Welshman to make sure the area remained loyal to the Lancastrians. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this didn't play very well with Richard of York. You know, he wanted to make a point. So he hired thousands of Welshmen under the command of William Herbert of Raglan to go to Carmarthen and capture the castle. And there was a big siege there between Edmund Tudor in Carmarthen Castle and Sir William Herbert outside.
Mm-hmm.
William Herbert was successful. He captured the castle, and Edmund Tudor was actually imprisoned in the castle over which he was supposed to be captain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 3 months later, Edmund Tudor dies. Now, the sources are a bit vague, and many people will say that Edmund Tudor simply died of the plague.
Uh-huh.
But nothing about the plague is mentioned at the time. I don't know where it comes from. It just seems to be one of these facts.
Okay.
And you see everywhere. You see it in many top historians' work. People just say he died of the plague. But yeah. Again, I've never actually found any evidence of that. I speculate without proof, I must say, that if he was released after a couple of months of siege in, you know, he was captured and imprisoned for 3 months, and then he was given his release allegedly in August and died in November. You know, who's to say that he didn't suffer some kind of wounds from being, you know, being under siege? Maybe he did die of the plague, but it was a plague that was, you know, brought on by being stuck in a dungeon, or at least being kept captive and not being given his full freedom. The point being that at 26 years old, Edmund Tudor died. I mean, and that's a premature death. Would he have died if he hadn't been attacked by the Yorkists? Possibly not.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously what's happened there is that Edmund Tudor's died because of an attack on him led by Sir William Herbert, who then
raises,
you know, four years later is given the wardship of Henry Tudor. So Henry Tudor then grew up at Raglan Castle, effectively in the household of the man probably responsible for his own father's death.
How did they treat him?
Henry Tudor?
Yeah.
Brought up as another son. He seems to have been brought up very well, highly respected. He had a great childhood. The evidence we have from, you know, people who discussed him as a child suggests he was given a top-level education. And also, he himself, Henry, as king, later said he believed he was kept prisoner there, not as in, you know, I'm behind cages, but because I don't have my own freedom of movement.
Mm-hmm.
But he was honourably brought up. Mm-hmm. So Henry Tudor had warm memories of his time at Raglan. He even rewarded Sir William Herbert's wife when he became king, because he was brought up well.
Yeah.
There's an overriding reason for this. William Herbert, the two most powerful and greatest Welsh families of the time were the Tudors and the Herberts. But one was Yorkist, one was Lancastrian. William Herbert had a daughter called Maud, and he wanted Maud to marry Henry Tudor. So there was very much an element of uniting two families, you know, ironically, like York and Lancaster, but in Wales going on. So William Herbert saw great things for his own family, his own descendants, through the Tudor blood. So any hostility doesn't seem to be passed on to the child, basically.
Yeah.
In any event, obviously, that marriage didn't go through because, you know, Henry returned, obviously, married Elizabeth of York.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, one thing I do speculate on, and I do like to imagine, is, okay, Henry said he was honourably brought up. You know, there were great plans for him. But how did he sit in the hall every day looking across at the man who possibly killed his father? Now, again, ironically, William Herbert became much more of a father to Henry Tudor, because Henry Tudor never met his own real father, who died 4 months before he was even born.
Right.
But it's a lot of, you know, great what ifs, and, you know, if only we could know situation about that. That's a weird way of working itself out.
So then the next day we're going to the Hampton Court of Wales. What can you tell me about that?
Carew Castle, another wonderful castle, pretty much like Raglan. This one is a little bit different in that it's based on a pond. And if you go around the other side of the pond, you get such incredible views of Carew Castle.
Yeah.
Carew Castle belonged, I mean, as the name suggests, it did historically belong to a family, the Carews, but it was bought by Rhys ap Thomas, he of Bosworth fame, in the 1480s. And yeah, in effect, it became known as, I mean, obviously not at the time, but what we now would regard it as the Hampton Court of Wales, in that it was the home of the most powerful figure in Welsh politics of the early Tudor period. And it became this great area of, you know, all the bards went there, all the poets went there, the musicians. It was Rhys ap Thomas's, you know, number one home in West Wales. Mm-hmm. Now Carew Castle is particularly important to the story of the early Tudors, in that Rhys ap Thomas in 1507, he held a major jousting competition at Carew. It was to celebrate his induction into the Order of the Garter, which was the greatest honour Henry VII gave to anyone. He didn't really believe in giving out earldoms or dukedoms. The one way Henry VII really showed his favour was the Order of the Garter, because you could only have, I think it's 24 people in that at one time. You have to wait for one to die to get in. So it's very exclusive. So he held the jousting competition to celebrate this, and also to celebrate, really, the Tudor dynasty. So 600 knights took part. You know, it was a really a colossal event, really. You know, the kind you'd only ever really see in London, perhaps, not, you know, backwater Wales.
Yeah.
And intriguingly, there was a scene there that he had two guys dressed up doing a pageant, one as St. David, obviously the Welsh patron saint, and one as St. George, the English patron saint. And at the end of the jousting competition, the two men embraced. And it's this very kind of visual symbol of Wales and England finally uniting as one, which, you know, in all intents, it did eventually go on to become. But it was this kind of really, this was the symbol, 1507 at Carew Castle, the Tudors, the Welsh Tudors, had taken over the English crown, and we were all now at peace, you know, after the wars that went on 8 years earlier. Yeah. The other thing about Carew that's fantastic, and something I perhaps sometimes unfairly gloss over because it's slightly outside my preferred period, is that in the, you know, 1580s, so, you know, a century after the Tudors came to the throne, the castle was owned by a guy called Thomas Perrot. Now, Thomas Perrot, there are, again, later rumours that he was actually an illegitimate son of Henry VIII. He had the famous ginger Tudor hair. He had an incredible temper. And there are some people who look at portraits of the men and say that they look rather similar. But more importantly, Thomas Perrot was a wild man, a loose cannon. And he kicked up a fuss many times during the reign of Elizabeth I. And she seemed to be very, very lenient with him, which again seems to suggest to some she didn't really want to discipline her half-brother, shall we say. Again, it's probably a bit of a reach, that story, but what Thomas Perrot did at Carew was he rebuilt the entire Great Hall, and he rebuilt one of the ranges. And it is, again, pictures will only do it justice unless you see it for yourself, in which case it's far greater to look upon. But he rebuilt the whole wing. And it's, again, I think it's one of the most finest examples of an Elizabethan fortress you're going to see, particularly if you stand across the pond on a sunny day and you really capture the sight of it. You almost have this kind of, you can see half of the castle wall is this great medieval fortress and the other half is this wonderful Elizabethan palace.
Yeah.
That's what we have to thank for a guy called Thomas Perrot, who did, however, eventually get executed by Elizabeth, but only after many, many years of him causing drama, really.
Yeah.
Huh. And I tell you what, there's one other thing as well, now remember, Carew, is above the entrance to the Great Hall, Rhys ap Thomas built a shield that held three coat of arms. And we can still see, you know, it's quite faint, but we can still see the stonework of where this coat of arms was built. Now, the coat of arms featured the arms of Henry VII in the middle, and on either side, the arms of his son, Prince Arthur, and also Catherine of Aragon. Now, this has led us to really date this coat of arms to either between 1499, when the pair, Catherine of Aragon and Arthur Tudor, were betrothed, and 1502, when he died. Yeah. So you get to see this actual coat of arms, or the stone remnants of it. And we know this is not just, it's somewhere in the Tudors, you know, it's somewhere within the 16th century. We could pretty much date it to within 3 years. which is quite a fantastic little tidbit, really. Yeah. They survived.
Wow. And so then that's really close to Pembroke Castle then.
It's about 5 miles. It's okay. You know, what you tend to get in this little small part of Wales, Pembrokeshire, because Pembrokeshire was on the front lines of the English versus Welsh kind of battles going on throughout the 11th, 12th, 13th century, you have a lot of castles and a lot of history within 20-mile radius sometimes. I mean, the castles down there are countless. But obviously Pembroke being the big daddy, you know, the famous one and birthplace of the Tudor dynasty, if you will.
Neat. Yeah. And so then we are also then making one more stop in Pembrokeshire to St. David's Cathedral. And what's there?
Well, St. David's Cathedral, it's the spiritual home of Wales. St. David is our patron saint. And we really do celebrate him quite well.
Yeah.
So St. David's itself is where his cathedral seat was. And it itself is a fascinating cathedral. You know, it's not as large or as grand as a York Minster, for example. But what's particularly great about St. David's Cathedral that I like is that it's only a mile or so inland from the sea. Now, St. David's kept on getting sacked throughout the Viking period. The Vikings would sail past, they would see the church, they would dock and burn it down. And I think in the year 999, a bishop got killed, and I think it got burnt down a couple of times, which, you know, with the year being 999, these guys must have thought it was the end of days, you know, right. They keep on getting killed. But the point being is that they rebuilt St. David's Cathedral in a dip, in a valley. So it can't be seen from the sea. So what you get when you get to St. David's, which in itself is a bit bizarre because it's the smallest city in the UK. I mean, St. David's is a village, but technically it's considered a city. So you end up in this really small village and you walk through a gatehouse and all of a sudden it's just there beneath you. You know, as opposed to most cathedrals built up high in the cities, you know, overlooking the town like Lincoln and York, etc. It's built in the valley. So it just suddenly appears before you. Never get to see it beforehand. It's just there. And it's breathtaking. You always, no matter how many times you go there, you always stop in your tracks. Like, wow, picture time. No matter how many times. You can go there 20 times a year, it's always the same. Stop, picture time, because it's just incredible.
Wow.
Now, the two things of note, really, that we have in St. David's, you know, discounting all the Welsh history that's in there, is, first of all, we have the tomb of Edmund Tudor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Edmund Tudor, as we said, died in Carmarthen. And when he died, he was buried initially in the Grey Friars. Mm-hmm. Now, the Grey Friars monastery was dissolved by Henry VIII. And many tombs, I mean, we must have lost thousands of tombs throughout the country. This tomb survived. We don't know by who. There's no evidence on the orders of Henry VIII, but somebody in West Wales decided to save the tomb, and it was moved to St. David's. You know, we can speculate the Welsh really were proud of the Tudors. You know, there's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
And I think somebody has taken upon themselves to maybe the bishops, maybe the church, you know, let's save this tomb.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that Owen Tudor's in Hereford tomb didn't survive, and that this Edmund Tudor's tomb was, there's no evidence, at least it was saved by Henry VIII, has led some to suggest this meant that Henry VIII didn't care about his Welsh ancestry. The Tudors didn't care about their Welsh Tudor ancestors. But Henry VIII, to be honest, didn't even save himself Henry Fitzroy, his own son's tomb. You know, that was left to the Dukes of Norfolk. So I don't think we can really say anything about Henry VIII. He didn't really seem a sentimental kind of guy in that case. But yeah, Edmund Tudor's tomb ended up right before the altar in St. David's Cathedral, which is probably the most, I mean, it's right next to where the shrine of St. David's would have been. and it's probably the most exalted place anyone could be buried in all of Wales. Mm. You know, whoever made that decision gave him the number one spot in all of Wales, right next to David's shrine in front of the altar. And it's still there, and it's a great little tomb. It's a square. We got a memorial brass on top, and we got all the relevant coats of arms on the tomb. You know, the Tudor arms, we got the King's arms, Catherine de Valois' arms, Jasper Tudor, Edmund Tudor. And it's as close, I think, as we can get to a royal tomb in Wales. It's, you know, other than the ancient Welsh princes that have survived. But certainly, from an English royal point of view, the only one I can think of that's there. And above it, and, you know, above most of the church, there's also, unusually, the nave at St. David's is wooden. I mean, obviously it's stone above, but from what you can see, there's a great wooden nave built all the way along the breadth and the width of the church. And it's a wooden one, and it was built in 1540. So around the time of the Reformation, so it's a great piece of Tudor, you know, woodwork. I am not aware I've seen anywhere else. You know, normally we're talking these great fan-vaulted naves. But St. David's has this unusual wooden one.
The next day, then, we're going to talk more about Jasper Tudor.
We are, yes. Edmund's little brother.
Yeah. And he really was the one who then became Henry's protector and kind of made it all happen, I suppose you could argue. What can you tell me about just kind of where we're going that relates to him?
What a relentless, you know, never say die character this guy was.
Yeah.
Which is, on one hand, bizarre because, you know, he didn't really have the background or the upbringing to be this force of nature that he eventually became. But what we're going to do is we're going to drive up the coast of West Wales, you know, a couple of hours up along the coast, which would have been very similar to the journey Henry Tudor would have taken on his way to Bosworth. And we're going to go up to a place called Harlech. Harlech is on the very west coast of North Wales. And Wales is known as the land of castles. And, you know, I don't want to keep on reiterating the point, but this is another unbelievable castle, you know, a real jewel in the crown, because it's built 200 feet up on a cliff overlooking Snowdonia, which is the Welsh, you know, national mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
So all you've got when you stand on top of Harlech is on one side the open sea and the other side a mountain range, and you're 200 feet up on a cliff. And it's, for that reason, it was impenetrable. Now, during the Wars of the Roses, 1461, Edward IV won the crown. You know, he won the battles of Towton and Mortimer's Cross, and the Lancastrians were gone. Now, Margaret of Anjou escaped, and she travelled all the way to Harlech, eventually left there and got to France. This was a castle and a region completely loyal to Jasper Tudor, and they didn't care that the Yorkists were on the throne. You know, they were Lancastrians, they were Tudor's men, they're going to stay loyal. The rest of England, the rest of Wales submitted. You know, a few castles up in Northumberland periodically kept, you know, went back and forth. But generally speaking, England and Wales were Yorkist. Edward IV had won. Yeah. But Harlech didn't. It held out. And in fact, it held out for 7 years. So for 7 years, the Yorkists kept on trying to get Harlech, and they couldn't. Jasper Tudor was coming in on boat, landing at Harlech, you know, grabbing some of his men, going on raids into North Wales, going back and escaping again.
Wow.
Now, this only reason this came to an end was because in 1468, you know, it's been 7 years of these raids, and Jasper went for it. And he landed, you know, got his men at Harlech, went out to the massive gatehouse, and went, you know, about 60 miles across North Wales, and he got to a Yorkist castle called Denby Castle, and he burnt it to the ground. Mm. He burnt the town. You know, he seems to have just gone on one, and this greatly upset Edward IV. Enough was enough. The man he hired, Sir William Herbert, him of Raglan, gave him thousands of men and told him, go get it. And they did. After 7 years, they finally starved out Harlech and the castle gave up. For which William Herbert was given the earldom of Pembroke, which had been stripped from Jasper Tudor. So you can see all these Herberts and these Tudors, their relationship is entwined. They're just the two greatest Welsh families of their age, and they are, you know, they're constantly bickering, warring. And this is another one, you know, we got Henry Tudor at Raglan, you know, his guardians come back. Oh, hiya, Henry. By the way, I've taken your uncle's castle, and now I'm the Earl of Pembroke.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of conversations are happening at this point between, you know, a growing up Henry and his new guardian? But nonetheless, Jasper had lost his one stronghold, you know. So he had spent 7 years basically doing these raids, you know, insurgency through North Wales. And when you go to Harlech and you stand up on that cliff, the sea on one end and a massive mountain range on the other, you can see why this castle is impenetrable, you know. There's a very famous song that the Welsh sing now called Men of Harlech. You know, it's one of those great Welsh traditional songs.
Men of Harlech, march to glory, victory is covering o'er ye. Right when freedom stands before ye, heed not the call.
A defiant song. They start singing the Men of Harlech, and it's all about standing firm. You can't defeat us, you know. We will always stand our ground. And it's kind of a bit of a Welsh kind of battle hymn. And that's what it's based off. It's based off those men for 7 years just saying, you know, you can't get us. And that was simply because of their loyalty to Jasper Tudor. He must have been some man for them to be willing to do that.
Yeah. I just love how these places are all so close to each other, because then that's also by the island of Anglesey where this whole thing starts, right?
Well, you know, you would say they're close together. We know Americans like to travel many hours to spots, but there'll be many South Welsh people who would never have gone, who've never been to Harlech.
Okay.
It's incredible. I mean, you think like, oh, it's only 3 hours away, but there seems to be a bit of a mental issue with us Brits and our traveling, you know, our 3 hours.
There's people in Los Angeles that I know who commuted to work 3 hours each way.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, so we're going to be able to see the island of Anglesey because that's relatively close.
It is, yeah. I mean, and at the end of the day, these are some of the most beautiful drives. You know, we're not talking freeways or motorways. We're talking nice sea views, mountain views.
Yeah.
It could be fantastic. I mean, you know, you could stop off every half a mile and see something incredible with Wales being Wales. But yeah, we'll go to Anglesey. You know, which in itself, crossing the bridge over the, it's a Victorian bridge, the Britannia, which in itself is going to be a wonderful thing. We will hopefully get to go to a village called Penmynydd. And Penmynydd, I mentioned at the start, is that ancestral village where the Tudors were from. Now, all that is there really is a sign saying, you know, welcome to Penmynydd, and a sign saying you are now leaving Penmynydd. And a telephone mast. But there is one house there that is a 16th century building, but it's built on the very site where the original Welsh Tudors lived, and which, you know, gives them the name we call them by, the Tudors of Penmynydd. And this place called Plas Penmynydd, which is something like, you know, Penmynydd House kind of scenario, is, you know, it's covered in Tudor imagery because it was built during the time the Tudors were on the throne, and they wanted this, you know, not the Tudors, but the guys who built this house really wanted to hark back to the start of the story. You know, and inside, by the fireplace, for example, they've recently found a bunch of fleur-de-lises. So, you know, the French coat of arms, which is obviously meant to be taken as a reference to Catherine de Valois, you know, the French ancestress, if you will, of the Tudors.
And then the next day six, We're going to be in a place that's really super important for Tudor history, right?
Conwy. We are, yes. Conwy. What I like about Conwy is it's almost the start and the end, in a way. Conwy Castle, another one of these incredible castles that's considered a World Heritage Site. It is important because it's the first real time we have the Tudors, as we know them, impact on the English political scene. Because, as you mentioned earlier, the Tudors of Penmynydd were the first cousins of Owain Glyndŵr, who led this Welsh rebellion. Mm-hmm. So his rebellion, after a year, was starting to flag. They were struggling to keep them, you know, the momentum going. Enter his cousins. Now, on April Fool's Day, 1401, April the 1st, the Tudors, two of them at least, decided they were going to capture Conwy Castle, which if you look at it and you think, how? Just how can you capture these castles? You know, as you've just seen, Harlech took 8 years or 7 years. Yeah. We've all seen the Hollywood movies of the effort needed to capture castles. And to be honest, generally, they were caught by simply starving them out for months on end. Yeah. But these two Tudors, they wanted to capture it, and they were going to capture it. So, according to the chronicles we have, what appears to have happened is on the 1st of April, which was a Sunday, the entire English town within were at church. They killed most of the guards, most of the knights, etc. A couple of them went up and knocked on the main gatehouse door, pretending to be carpenters who had come to fix something. The guards let them in, at what point they got their throat slit, and the gates were open to a band of Welshmen who simply went in and took the castle while everyone was at church.
Wow.
They burned all the records, because obviously what you had at this time in Wales was English towns and Welsh towns next to them. You know, in that the Welsh were treated like second-class citizens. The English lived in the castle. They had all of the records. They owned all the lands. But those two Tudors, they simply went in, burned all the records. And of course, you know, back then they didn't have any digital copies. The records are gone. The records are gone. So it was one of these incredible moments in Welsh history where, you know, a handful of guys have captured a mighty Royal English fortress.
Yeah.
It didn't last, and it couldn't last, really. I mean, you know, you really flicked the nose of the English king there, and, you know, he came in all guns blazing and got the castle back.
Yeah.
But it was definitely a, you know, you'll remember us now moment from the pair, and ultimately probably got them executed, you know, 8 or 9 years later. You know, it's the kind of thing an English king is not really going to forget.
Yeah. No, for
sure. Across the town then, we have a place called Plas Mawr. Plas Mawr kind of translates like, you know, big house or big area. And what we have here is a house that was built in the Elizabethan period by a family called the Wynns. Now, the Wynns, you know, in 1485, there was one of them at the Battle of Bosworth. He helped Henry II to become king. He got lots of money, lots of land. Fast forward a couple of generations later, you know, they're this loaded North Welsh family, and they wanted to build a big house that showed everybody. And that was what Plas Mawr was. It was built, you know, I think, you know, between 1576 and 1586, you know, a 10-year period during Elizabeth the First reign. It survives almost intact. I mean, it's obviously been renovated a little bit, like most of these places have. But I have yet to come across an Elizabethan townhouse bigger or more complete than Plas Mawr.
Mm.
It's incredible. It's just a really fantastic building. And if I had a couple of million going to spare, I would buy it. It is. I mean, just from the very gate, I mean, the gatehouse leads onto the main road.
Yeah,
you know, you've got these Tudor coat of arms above it with the Welsh dragon. You walk in, you've got a courtyard, you've got all these different rooms. And the best thing about them is they've been painted. A lot of these places you go to just either have brick walls or they have them whitewashed white.
Right.
They painted these walls inside as they believe they would have looked. See, it's so colourful. It's fantastic. You know, lots of coats of arms, lots of monograms for, you know, E for Elizabeth, JW everywhere for John Wynne, who owned the house at that point.
Wow.
And it really is, again, get onto Google, give this place a, type in Plasmaur, which Plasmaur, and you'll see what I mean. It's incomparable to anything I've come across. And it's right in the heart of the town as well. It's not some sort of, you know, palace that's out in the sticks like a Hardwick Hall or a, you know, any other of these big country manors we know of. It's town centre, opens onto the street. And obviously, for that reason, it's quite compact the way it's built, but it's really, you know, you've got the chambers, the pantry, the kitchens. It's
very, very,
again, the only way I can really keep it, it's complete. It's just a complete house, which we are, you know, they're very few and far between these days.
That's so great. I'm so excited. I love hearing all of this. I'm so excited. and along the way, we're going to have experts and talks and from lots of different people at a lot of these places too. So people will be getting more than just you talking as well. So not that you're not great too, but so did I miss anything?
After that, we're probably going to one. We'll go to one other place as well called Gwydir Castle, which is heading back south from the coast, inland a little bit into the middle of the mountain range. And Gwydir Castle must be one of the most romantic places left in the UK regarding the Tudors. Probably more of a modern romantic story in a way, because this was another belonging to the same family I've just mentioned, the Wynne family. You know, as you're going to see, these guys were really flashing the wealth. They built this incredible manor house in a place called Gwydir. It fell into ruin. I think it fell into ruin gradually about 1920s. It was owned at one point by the Hearst family, it just fell into disrepair, collapsed and became overgrown. You know, all the roof had caved in until the early 90s, and a couple from London or from England somewhere bought it. You know, they were hiking or something during that time, and they came across it. They said they went through all the brambles and all the bushes, and they came across the remnants of this old Elizabethan manor.
Yeah.
I think one was an artist and one was a writer. And they bought it.
That's so
amazing. And they gradually, the last 20 years, have been set about renovating it, faithfully. So, you know, they've been in the news quite a bit because they've been trying to get the original wooden paneling. Because about in the 1920s, 1930s, all the wooden paneling was taken out, broken up and sold to American investors and so on.
Oh, wow.
So they've ended up all around the place, you know, in Vegas, New York, etc., museums, and they've been step by step getting them all back. You know, that's a great feat to really do, because the sheer research having to go through to try and find them. And it's still a work in progress. It's probably more on the edge of finish now than it has been in recent times. It is, again, astounding. It's an astounding place, Gwydir Castle. And what's great is that, you know, it's this romantic story between this young couple in the 90s who bought it and did it up.
Yeah.
Incredibly, it has a priest's hall behind the fireplace.
Wow.
So it's obviously played a part in the whole Elizabethan Catholic versus Protestant kind of era. I mean, I wouldn't have liked to have slipped into a hole behind a fireplace, but
right.
I guess some of those priests have to do what they have to do.
Yeah.
Anyone who's recently watched the Gunpowder TV series, if anyone's been able to pick that up, they'll kind of know what was going on.
Was it a Nicholas Owen one? Do you know? Do we know who if it was?
I don't know who it was.
Okay. No. Okay. Yeah. I would love to see one of his sometime. He was a genius with that. We could go on forever here, and I would love to. And I think people can come on the tour, and then they can have it go on for a week or more. A week is what we're doing here, 7 days. So for people who want to learn more, you can go to my website, to englandcast.com/tours, and I'll put a big thing on the front page too. For people who can't go on the tour, like, how can people learn more about visiting Tudor, Wales? Do you like have a book or anything like that?
I do, you know. It is a book very aptly titled Tudor Wales. And it is all about the Tudors in Wales. I mean, we've discussed today, what, 4 or 5 separate places. My book, we have 40 of these places. I've got them all across Wales, South Wales, Mid Wales, North Wales. And some you will have heard of in the book. You know, everyone's heard of Pembroke Castle. I think many people would have heard of, you know, Cardiff Castle, things like that. But I have quite small places in there, proper, where I can see the hidden gems. You know, yeah. We've got places such as the Merchant's House in Tenby. We've got Lamphy Bishop's Palace, Neath Abbey, and so on. There's many little places in there that even Welsh people aren't aware of. Nobody ever thinks of Wales when we discuss the Tudors, which is bizarre because they were Welsh. We can all discuss Hever, Hampton Court and Stratford, for example, till, you know, the cows come home. But there's so much more out there that we can be looking at, and they've all got something to give. You know, even if it's a ruin, it might have still one lovely little chimney place or fireplace. I mean, all Tudor history. Everything meant something to somebody.
Yeah.
And look hard enough, and they're always connected back to those kings and queens. If that is what really interests you. It's more, and I'm sure I will come across much more the more I look into it.
Yeah, that's so great. Well, thank you so much for, for taking the time to walk us through all these places. I'm super stoked to go on this tour, and I am sure that lots of other people now who are listening to this will also be. So be sure to check out the website for information to get the full itinerary and everything like that.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.